Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and Ashley Hunt, a Senior Account Executive at LS2 Group, an Iowa-based PR firm. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. Unified government came to an end in Washington, at least for the next 2 years, after the midterm elections on November 6th. Before the election, Republicans held a comfortable 23-seat majority in the U.S. House. Democrats, however, picked up that, and then some, to take the majority. Republicans maintained control of the Senate, even gaining a seat or two depending on how recent recounts turn out. With their new majority in the House, Democrats will take over leadership roles on several influential committees, such as Ways and Means, the Judiciary, Foreign Affairs, Oversight and Government Reform, Budget, and Transportation and Infrastructure, all of which could have an impact on key government processes like appropriations. In fact, several spending bills are set to expire on December 7th, and with a now divided government, finishing this year's appropriations process may have just gotten a little more difficult, as if the two parties had been working well together to begin with. Democrats have already started leveraging their new position on proposals that are likely to be issues with Republicans, such as a proposal to tie a spending deal to legislation aimed at protecting Special Counsel Robert Mueller, and strong opposition to funding for one of the president's top priorities, an expanded border wall. If negotiations stall, with a deadline looming, it is entirely possible that Congress will decide to punt on decisions by passing a large continuing resolution that keeps funding at fiscal year 2018 levels for some departments, or we might even experience a partial shutdown. Up next, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby will join me to discuss how the midterm elections will impact fiscal policy and the budget process in the years ahead. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. Bob is a regular contributor on Facing the Future, a fiscal policy expert, and a connoisseur of all things maple. Thank you for joining the show once again, Bob.
Well, you're welcome, Chase. Let me just put down my maple donut here and concentrate on fiscal policy.
So, for anyone who's been living in a bunker for the last several months, and perhaps they're just now coming out of it, we just had a midterm election. The Democrats took the majority in the U.S. House. Republicans held on to the Senate. And 2020 looks to be very interesting. Being in the Granite State, we've already got candidates coming through and starting to make their pitch. And I wanted to talk to you, Bob, today in our first show post-election, to get an idea from you what the fiscal policy environment or even the budget process environment might look like for the next couple years of divided government now that there's a different party majority in the House compared to the Senate and even in the executive branch.
I don't know how much more gridlock can be, but we could be facing an even more tense face-off between the two parties on spending and taxes as we confront now divided government. One thing that did happen this year was in the appropriations process, they did manage to get five of the appropriation bills passed on time before the end of the last fiscal year. And those five bills encompassed most of the spending. There are seven bills that they still have to pass, but they're smaller bills. So they got about 75% to 80% of discretionary funded funding passed before they before the end of the last fiscal year. But now we're back to Washington. They still have these seven bills that they have to pass with about the remaining 25%. And if they don't get that done by December 7th, the government will shut down. We'll have another little shutdown controversy.
And to sort of piggyback off of that, Bob, how likely do you think it is we'll see a shutdown versus just some, you know, enormous continuing resolution with those seven remaining appropriations bills?
I think it's pretty likely that there's going to be a long-term continuing resolution. I doubt that there's going to be a shutdown. I think that probably both sides, and including the White House, will just want to assess how, you know, just let the dust settle a little bit from the elections, and the easiest thing to do is pass a CR into next year and agree that they're going to fight about things when they come back. That's what I guess is going to happen. There's always the possibility that that there might be, you know, it could be that the Democrats will be feeling their oats about something and will want to attach something to a CR that the Republicans don't want. It could be that the White House will get upset about the border wall funding and threaten to shut down the government. So there are things that could happen, but I suspect that they'll be exhausted from the elections and just want to get out of town.
That was my next question, and that was, you know, what are some potential roadblocks in this divided government trying to get through those next seven appropriations bills or a continuing resolution? You mentioned a couple. Are there any others?
Well, those are the big ones. I mean, the controversy over the wall funding is what prevented them from getting more of the spending bills done by the end of the year. They'd agreed to hold that one off. And so the dispute there is that the House has approved $5 billion, and the Senate has only approved $1.6 billion. So obviously the president favors the higher number from the House, and they'll have to work that out. And like I said, they might just pass a continuing resolution. But that's one of the things that could happen. You heard some people talking over the weekend, last weekend, about attaching some sort of protect the special counsel, protect Bob Mueller provision onto the spending bills. Well, I'm sure that would get that might draw a presidential veto and a threat of a shutdown were it to happen. So that could be something that might come up.
Bob, looking ahead at the fiscal year 2020 budget process, which ideally should be starting relatively soon, do you think having a divided government here, especially when it comes to a Democratic majority in the House, a Senate majority, a Republican majority in the Senate, how difficult might the fiscal year 2020 process be compared to the last couple of years of what I would say relatively easy process because of the increase in budget caps?
Well, I think it's still going to be difficult. I think it might be even more difficult with the House being in control of one party and the Senate in the other. The different thing about 2020, when you look at the appropriations bills, is that the agreement that they had in place for the last 2 years has run up. So they agreed to lift the caps for 18 and 19, but they didn't reach any agreement on lifting the caps for 20 and 21. So as we go into preparation for fiscal year 2020, the approved level, the cap actually comes down. So unless it comes down from 2019 levels, it's where it was originally for 2020. So, I mean, the problem there is unless they reach a new agreement to raise the cap, they're going to have less money to allocate for the appropriations bills in 2020, and that will make things even more difficult.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, about post-midterm election fiscal policy and budget process, what the next couple of years might look like. And picking up on what you just said there, Bob, how likely is it that Congress raises those caps again for fiscal year 2020, as opposed to letting those lower caps sort of come into play while they're trying to negotiate the next budget?
Well, I think this gives them a chance. Now, here's where split government might actually be a good thing, because it might prompt a negotiation, because both sides will realize that they can't have their own way, and they're going to have some sort of a compromise. So unless there's a desire on one part or the other to shut down the government as some sort of a demonstration, it will be that they're going to have to reach some sort of compromise, and that means that it would likely involve an increase in the existing cap for 2020. I think that that's one of the things that we'll see, and it may be a two-year deal like they did last time, raising it for both 20 and 20 and 21. So we'll see how that'll come out. The Democrats will want to raise the cap. The Republicans will probably want something in return, although they really want the cap raised also, by the way. they're just as happy to spend the money. So, we'll see if the new Congress and the president have some ability to work a deal here on. If they can't work a deal on one-year appropriations, they certainly can't reach a deal on the bigger questions that they're going to have to face.
And the idea of raising those budget caps, for me, it kind of makes me cringe in the environment that we're currently in fiscally, where we're seeing large tax cuts sort of undercut revenue. Spending is growing almost on autopilot because of some of those larger programs. This reminds me of a Congressional Budget Office report, or CBO report, that just came out sort of recapping what the last couple fiscal years looked like and what the next fiscal year or two is projected to look like as it pertains to budget deficits, and maybe even what Congress might be facing when they come into this next appropriations process or budget cycle. Can you give a little bit of a summary there of what CBO saw and what they're forecasting as the sort of the immediate future?
Well, it was a nice little summary of what happened in fiscal year 2018. The deficit, I like to look at these things as a percentage of the economy. The deficit was $779 billion, but it was 3.8% of the GDP, which was up from 3.5% last year and 3.2% the year before. And if that doesn't sound like much, it's kind of a big deal, because the deficit is rising faster than the economy is growing, and that means that the debt is rising as a percentage of our economy. And that's really the ball game. I mean, what we should be trying to do is stabilize the debt to GDP ratio, particularly because we're in a period where the economy is growing fast. And so ideally, you should have that debt to GDP ratio, or deficit to GDP ratio, shrinking rather than growing.
And you mentioned the nominal budget deficit for fiscal year 2018. I think it was $779 billion, you said. And that was, 3.8% of the economy, or GDP. But if I remember correctly, CBO actually said that figure could have been larger because of what they categorized or called timing shifts in federal payments. Can you maybe explain what that means, and is it something of significance?
Well, there's some oddities if the last first day of the fiscal year begins on a weekend, for example, that can shift payments from one year into another year, or use things that would have been counted in one year or counted in the prior year. So CBO says that, October 1st, 2017, which was the first day of fiscal year 2018, actually fell on a weekend, and they say that if not for that quirk, the deficit in 2018 would have been $823 billion, or 4.1% of GDP. So it actually, the number is actually a little bit worse than it looks.
So, Bob, we're looking at the reality of a divided government and a lame duck Congress, and all of these things are swirling around in my head in terms of what Republicans were working on in terms of policy pursuits and what was being promised by both parties at the midterm election, at least leading up to it. And one thing that jumped out to me was the fact that there were all these promises of more tax cuts. One specifically was a potential 10% middle-income, average American tax cut that President Trump was throwing out there. Then there were Democratic proposals of other tax cuts. Either way, I think we've talked ad nauseum about tax cuts not paying for themselves on the show. But what do you think the reality is in terms of seeing an extension of the most recent tax cut or another tax overhaul in the next couple of years for Congress?
Well, it's inevitable that there will be some reconsideration because the tax cut that they passed last year comes with an expiration date at the end of 2025. So they don't need to deal with it right away, but they certainly will deal with it at some point. And having the Democrats now control the House and the Republicans control the Senate, you could find some dueling priorities about tax policy. So, you know, for example, the way it might come up is if the Democrats had some program that they wanted to pass, whether it's related to health care or infrastructure, and wanted it not to increase the deficit, they might choose to roll back some of the, say, the corporate tax cut to pay for it, and then Republicans would object, and they could get into a fight about that, and could have some sort of could be the basis of some sort of negotiation. So I'd say that everything is on the table at this point, but it's unlikely right now, I would think, that anything big is going to get done.
All right, one last question, Bob, before we go. It's safe to say during the midterm election, fiscal policy was not a top priority or even a major talking point. But in New Hampshire, the 2020 cycle has begun, and we've already got presidential candidates coming in here and making their pitch. What do you hope to hear from presidential candidates and even members of Congress over the next couple of years leading into the next presidential election when it comes to fiscal policy issues?
I want them to at least talk about the issue. They're going to have different approaches to what to do about it, and that's fine. But don't duck the issue altogether. It's going to be awfully difficult to do, frankly, because the deficit is going to be over $1 trillion, and they're going to be seeking to take over a federal government that's hemorrhaging, just bleeding, gushing red ink. And I do think that particularly in a state like New Hampshire, that is going to be an issue. And I think it's going to be very difficult with these trillion-dollar deficits for candidates to propose, major new spending programs or major new tax cuts without explaining what you're going to do, how you're going to keep the debt from going up. That's got to be a major, major issue in the upcoming campaigns.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Bob Bixby discuss the post-midterm election fiscal policy environment and what the next couple of years might look like in terms of the budget process. As always, thanks for joining the show, Bob.
You're welcome.
Up next, Ashley Hunt will join me to discuss grassroots and social media initiatives and whether they can have an impact going into 2020. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Senior Account Executive at LS2, Ashley Hunt. Ashley specializes in issue advocacy, public affairs, and event management for LS2, an Iowa-based bipartisan public relations, government affairs, public affairs, and marketing firm. Ashley also used to be a colleague of mine and worked with the Concord Coalition. She serves on several local and community boards and is a proud Iowa State University grad. Welcome to Facing the Future, Ashley.
Thanks, Chase. I'm excited to be here.
We're happy to have you on the show. Ashley, I don't want to say that New Hampshire is better than Iowa, but I'm probably going to insinuate it. It's always fun to talk with people from the first caucus state, given that we're in the first primary state.
And so, technically, we're before you, so we could argue about who's better another time.
Yeah, sure, we could have that argument, but I'm gonna stick with the Granite State. You know, that's just me having the last say because I'm the host. Moving on, we've actually had some presidential candidates rolling through already. How about you guys?
Yeah, we've actually been seeing candidates for the last 6 months at least, if not even longer. After the midterms, last Tuesday, Wednesday morning, we woke up to an article by the Des Moines Register saying, all right, Iowa, midterms are over. It is now caucus season. So there's no break here.
Yeah, the same with us. We jumped right into having presidential candidates in the state, had some events with pundits and politicos and pollsters literally the day after the midterm election. So it's certainly 2020 cycle full swing already. I wonder, before we jump in, I wanted to have you on the show, Ashley, not just to compare Iowa and New Hampshire, but to talk a little bit about what you do with LS2. And break down grassroots and social media initiatives. But before we do that, can you give us a little taste of what you do in your day job and what it's like for you?
Okay, where do I begin? I've been with LS2 Group, I guess, on and off, because I did have a stint full-time with the Concord Coalition, for a little over 4 years. We specialize, I guess, our bread and butter is really the public affairs and issue advocacy work. So here at LS2 Group, it is a ton of former campaign staffers, people who have worked in state government, run for office, a lot of what we like to call politicos work here. So a lot of the stuff we do does have some state and federal policy twists to it. So what I do is I do a lot of the public affairs and issue advocacy. So we work with grassroots stakeholders across the state. We talk to them and find out what issues are important to them, and basically just arm them with the tactics to talk to their elected officials or any candidates, hint, hint, presidential candidates, about these issues. So we give them talking points. We just give them a place to start. And the most important thing about this is finding those Iowans that already care about the issue and just giving them sort of the confidence and the tools to bring those issues to light to the people who represent them in government. I also do a lot of sort of digital marketing stuff at LS2 Group, a lot of social media, a little bit with some websites, newsletters, that sort of thing. And we're seeing social media play a lot more of a role in public affairs and issue advocacy than we've seen in the past even 4 years since I began my professional career here. So when I first started doing some of this public affairs and issue advocacy stuff, it was all going face-to-face and talking to the candidates or the elected officials, sending in faxes or snail mail letters, placing phone calls. And now we're seeing even some push on getting on your Twitter, tagging, you know, Senator Chuck Grassley, who's our senior senator in Iowa, and saying, hey, you should read this article, or, you know, I hope you fight for XYZ issue in Congress. So it's interesting to see the technology shift.
I have questions in relation to that. Maybe I'll start off with, has the switch towards social media focus been successful? Have you seen a fair amount of engagement with candidates for Congress or president or current elected officials when you take that next step and dive into the digital side of grassroots?
You know, I think, honestly, it depends on the candidate or the elected official. So going back to my example of Senator Chuck Grassley, we've done a lot of issue advocacy with him on social because he is known for being kind of a Twitter fanatic, and he runs his own tweets. He does all of it himself. We're now in the era of President Donald Trump, who also runs his own Twitter account. That's sort of not something we've seen historically very often. And so I think now with the president being such a major player on Twitter, and we're learning so much about his policies via social channels, I think we're seeing more electeds hop on to using Twitter and Facebook and Instagram even as tools to connect with voters and their constituents. So it depends. You'll have senators or congressmen and women who have their staff solely running their social accounts. And I think the general consensus is it's still successful either way. We want to get that issue in front of, you know, if there's somebody, a staff member running a social media channel, they're probably pretty high up in that person's staff. So we want to see them, you know, take that issue to the candidates. But seeing more actual people running their own accounts, I think that's really been beneficial for us who are trying to find ways to directly connect to our elected officials.
So, Ashley, I think I'm a bit of a dinosaur in the millennial generation, though I'm in that same generational category as you. I don't even use Instagram or follow Pinterest or do Snapchat. I kind of have the basic bevy of Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. So maybe I'm a bit of an old soul in the millennial generation. But since we're talking about trends, I wanted to get your perspective on what has changed in grassroots initiatives and engagement, even since the 2016 presidential into the 2018 midterm, and what you see for 2020.
You know, something that I thought was super interesting with the midterms was the amount of people engaged in the election this year. As we all know, midterms are generally not as well paid attention to as a presidential. And I found it interesting just looking at my friends, followers, etc., how many people were really engaged via social media on voting. And I just think we saw this massive turnout of millennials talking about the importance of voting. And I will say, I think it was also really interesting that it was not as much vote red, vote blue. It was get out and vote, because what happens when we don't vote is scary. Let's make our voices heard. So I thought that was super interesting. The way that social media has allowed for young people to really see what their peers are doing, see that their peers are engaged, and then get involved in the political process. I think that was sort of my biggest takeaway on social media, you know, since the last election, just in the last 2 years. The other thing that I think has been interesting, and we're continuing to see that, is that social media lets the everyday citizen become a journalist. And so we have cameras, we have the internet and the greater public at the tips of our fingers every single minute of the day, because who leaves their house without a smartphone anymore? And so taking a picture or even recording a candidate doing their stump speech, two clicks and that's out to your 1,000 Twitter followers or your 1,500 Facebook friends. And so I think that it's just making the political process more available to everyone. Another thing I thought was super interesting, I'm sure that you saw this in New Hampshire, but in Iowa, we had the debates, we had a huge gubernatorial race, and so we had the debates. They were on, you know, each TV station, different parts of the state, but they were also streamed via Facebook Live. And I think that there was, you know, when I couldn't watch a debate that was in a town 2 hours away because my TV screen doesn't get that market, I just went to Facebook, searched the TV station, and there it was. And in addition to that, we were seeing segments that were solely on Facebook and not on the actual television station. So reporters were interviewing top candidates, both the gubernatorial, other statewide positions, federal delegation races. Those interviews were just on Facebook. You couldn't find them on the actual station. So I think it was just interesting to see how people are covering the elections and how people are talking about the elections. It's almost more so happening on social media rather than some of those traditional channels we've seen in the past.
It's a really interesting dynamic to see how connected we are and how far-reaching a message can be, whether it's through, you know, just your own network on social media or paying for additional advertisements on those platforms. This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Ashley Hunt from the LS2 Group in Iowa. We're talking about grassroots initiatives, especially when it comes to social media. And I wanted to ask Ashley as a follow-up, in the 2020 election, do you think grassroots efforts are going to be pretty different as a result of this dynamic shift to online, internet, social media-based engagement? Or do you think there will be still a pretty heavy dose of what you would consider the more traditional grassroots efforts?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a mix of both, and I think it's also going to depend on where you are. In Iowa, we're pretty traditional. We don't like change super often, and at least our elected officials, you know, we've got Senator Chuck Grassley, who's 85. He's been a senator for I don't know how many years. I think he's the second most long-term senator in the Senate right now. We just had Governor Terry Branstad, who is the longest-serving governor in the nation's history, before we had our current governor. And so we're traditional. And so in that sense, I really think at least in Iowa, we'll see a mixture, of course. We'll see more social media trickling in. But I really do think that the most effective grassroots efforts are still going to be centered around some of those traditional tactics, especially that face-to-face. Iowans love that we get to meet presidential candidates and that they're coming to the state so often. And so really that face-to-face is going to reign king, I think. That said, I think as we go on and maybe in, you know, 4 more years after 2020, we might see a shift there, but I don't see it happening just yet.
Yeah, Ashley, I think you're right, especially in states like Iowa and New Hampshire, where we're used to having presidential candidates literally in our living rooms shaking hands and talking to us about the issues. I think we'll at least still see a pretty strong blend of traditional grassroots efforts, in, you know, tied in with the more social media, internet-based engagement. So I guess another question I have for you is sort of this global perspective. When it comes to organizations like the Concord Coalition, it's a nonpartisan nonprofit. I'm sure you have clients similar to us. What do you see as the recipe for success when they're pushing maybe a certain policy agenda or a certain set of issues in terms of getting their message above the fold and sort of cutting through the rhetoric and noise?
Yeah, so I would say throughout the process of the 2016 caucus, the first budget initiative, which of course is Concord Coalition Fix the Debts initiative they had for the caucus and primary in New Hampshire and Iowa last time around, I think we did a really great job. I think what is super important in an organization coming and breaking through is coming early. When it's 3 months, 6 months even before the caucus or the primary in the case of New Hampshire, there are hundreds of groups coming in trying to last minute get their word out, get their messages out, and trying to make a difference. Iowans are inundated by that time. We've been to a ton of town halls. We've met a bunch of the candidates, and we've already decided what the issues are that matter the most to us. So it's really important to come in early, find those grassroots and grass tops, so a mixture of your everyday people and those people who really will make a difference and are super influential to a candidate. Finding a mixture of those people, talking to them early and putting them on, you know, a cabinet or making them a part of your coalition, making them feel special early and reminding them that this is an issue early is super important because, you know, if you wait, then you're just, you know, fifth down, and they already have their top three issues that they're already worried about. So coming in early is, I would give that advice to anyone. I think that's the only way to break through is coming in early and finding the right people before they've already made up their mind about another issue being their top issue.
And I have just a couple more questions for you, Ashley, before we've got to let you go here. We're running short on time. One is, do you think there's going to be a generational divide in how we approach grassroots sort of at an organizational perspective and an issue perspective? Do you think we're going to see a millennial generation that's very active online and perhaps very active in terms of volunteering compared to a baby boomer generation that is aging and perhaps less engaged? Or do you think they're both sort of going to be going head to head in this next election?
That's a really interesting question. I think I would relate it back to what we saw in Iowa during the midterms, and we've got this massive, at least in our state, urban-rural divide that was made very clear by some of the races that were won and lost last week. We're seeing urban voters trend toward being more progressive, more liberal, more blue, where we've got our rural voters tending to be more red, and I think more traditional. And I think, you know, if you look at the statistics there, you'll see our urban centers, Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, they have a lot more young people. Des Moines is always rated, you know, number one or two best place in the country for young professionals. So we've got a lot of those millennials. And then, of course, in your rural areas, you've got some of those baby boomers and older. So I think there will be a divide. I hope that some of the baby boomers and more traditional folks are sort of coming to terms with the fact that social media is the new media, as we see newspapers cutting staff, going completely from print to completely online. I think that's the way our nation's headed. As I said before, Iowans traditional, so I hope that at least in Iowa we sort of see that all together we move. I think there will be a little bit of a disconnect, but I'm optimistic in that together we'll all sort of shift to that digital space and seeing, you know, what that means for advocacy and what it means for elected officials, talking to their constituents. You know, you see celebrities going on Instagram stories and doing Q&As on Facebook Live and Instagram Live. Are we going to see that shift with our elected officials? I would guess yes, eventually we will see a lot of our officials taking that route. I don't know how quickly it's going to happen, but long term I think we'll see a shift of most people, no matter their generation, toward that digital space.
All right, Ashley, one more question. You mentioned First Budget, which was an effort by the Concord Coalition to fix the debt, as you said, in the 2016 cycle. Do you think it's possible for some aspect of fiscal policy to become a top issue in the 2020 cycle? If yes, if no, why?
Gosh, that's a tough question. Obviously, you know that fiscal policy is near and dear to my heart, so I may be biased, but I think it could be a top issue. We are seeing more people talk about the fact that the nation's at its highest debt ever and that sort of thing. But at least in Iowa, we're also talking a lot about all of the tax cuts that the Trump administration has done. Our Governor Reynolds and Republican-led state legislator, they've got a ton of tax cuts in the works too. And so it's sort of contradictory to some of the fiscal responsibility issues that we talk about. Of course, there's stuff on the left too. I don't think it's going to be a top issue, but I think it could be a issue.
Well, I hope it's at least an issue. Like you mentioned, we've got record-setting debt levels and growing budget deficits. So I'm hopeful that through our efforts once again during this cycle, we can see some elevation of those issues. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Ashley Hunt look ahead at 2020 and discuss what grassroots efforts might look like in this upcoming presidential cycle. Thank you for joining the show, Ashley.
Thanks so much, Chase.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. During election night coverage of the 2018 midterm, I kept seeing over and over again on different media outlets and stations that healthcare was polling as the biggest concern for voters during the election. So, that being the case, I thought it would be a good time to introduce you to one of the Concord Coalition's primers. This one is on healthcare. So I guess it's time to face the facts in our healthcare system. The United States healthcare system is larger than the gross domestic product or economy of all but five other nations. Over the past several decades, healthcare costs have outpaced economic growth, inflation, and personal incomes. One out of every $6 of the nation's annual production of goods and services is now devoted to healthcare. The implications of healthcare spending's continued growth extend beyond traditional healthcare concerns, such as the availability and delivery of medical services. This growth is a major factor in national economic policy. A consensus exists across ideological and partisan divides that, one, as a nation, we are not getting what we pay for when we spend as much as we do on healthcare, and two, healthcare spending growth in the U.S. is on an unsustainable path. Numerous problems come from such a large, costly, and growing healthcare system. In the private sector, healthcare costs are eroding companies' bottom lines. Americans fortunate enough to
to have employer-sponsored health insurance increasingly are paying more for their premiums or are seeing their wages stagnate as their employers pay higher premiums themselves. In the public sector, projected cost growth for Medicare and Medicaid is the single largest contributor to our nation's unsustainable fiscal outlook. As the search for solutions continues, it seems clear that there is no magic bullet. Adopting policies that simply cut benefits or limit provider payments might leave the system better off in a strictly fiscal sense, but could severely reduce access to quality care. And raising new revenues to fund the current system or expand coverage to more of the uninsured is important, but does nothing to control healthcare inflation over the long term or improve the value of services received. In the end, it will take a mix of strategies to bring healthcare costs down to a sustainable level while improving quality and value. And it will take a bipartisan approach to tackle the issues. In fact, I think it would be important to talk a little bit more about the major federal healthcare programs. The federal government subsidizes the healthcare of most American adults in a variety of ways, depending on their age, military service, employment status, income, and health. The majority of Americans have employer-based coverage, which is subsidized through preferential tax treatment. Middle and lower-income individuals who do not have access to employer-provided health insurance are eligible for tax credits under the Affordable Care Act. The rest of the insured are covered directly through government-run insurance programs. Of these programs, the government spends the most on Medicare. It provides health insurance for nearly all Americans over 65, as well as workers who have become disabled. It is available regardless of income, although higher income individuals have higher premiums. And Medicare has four parts. Part A is hospital insurance, which is financed by the Medicare payroll taxes on current workers, covers hospital services, post-hospital service, and hospice care. Part B is supplementary medical insurance, which is financed by premiums that pay for around 25% of the program, with general federal tax revenues paying the remainder. It covers physician services, outpatient hospital care, home health care, and medical equipment, and it's optional coverage, but most seniors actually subscribe. Part C, or Medicare Advantage, provides private insurance product options for beneficiaries enrolled in Parts A and B. Part D, the fourth part of Medicare, is prescription drug coverage. And it's financed by general tax revenues and premiums. It provides optional prescription drug coverage for older Americans and the disabled. Like Social Security, parts of Medicare have dedicated revenue sources and a trust fund designated to maintain the link between these revenues and the program's spending. However, because the program relies on general revenue subsidies significantly more than Social Security, these trust funds are of limited value in determining the long-term fiscal health of the program. The second largest federal healthcare program in terms of spending is Medicaid, although it actually covers more people than Medicare. Medicaid provides health insurance and long-term care for low-income Americans. While the federal government usually pays more than half of the costs, the program is administered by the states, subject to minimum federal requirements for basic benefits. In state through the Affordable Care Act, all adults between ages 18 and 65 are eligible for coverage if they have incomes at or below 138% of the federal poverty line. In states that chose not to expand Medicaid to be eligible, individuals must fall into one of these several dozen eligibility categories that divide into three general groups: families with children, elderly people, and people with mental or physical disabilities. In addition to expanding insurance coverage through Medicaid, the ACA, or Affordable Care Act, allows individuals and families to purchase private health insurance coverage through state-based health insurance exchanges or marketplaces. Those with certain income levels, roughly between 130% and 400% of the federal poverty level, are eligible for tax credits to cover portions of their premiums, and they can receive additional subsidies to reduce out-of-pocket cost-sharing expenses. The federal government also operates a number of smaller health programs. These include the State Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, which funds health benefits for children from low-income families and health programs for members of the military and civilian federal employees. And of course, we couldn't talk about healthcare spending at the federal level without discussing the long-term trends affecting our healthcare system. The long-term growth of healthcare costs has a large impact on the nation's fiscal sustainability. Increasing numbers of beneficiaries due to the aging of the population alone will increase spending on healthcare. Healthcare cost growth per capita has slowed recently. However, the durability of that slowdown is unknown, and most healthcare economists are concerned about cost growth rising in the future. Nevertheless, there is a fair amount of bipartisan consensus on some steps that still need to be taken to reduce healthcare cost growth, and that the sooner the changes are made, the quicker we can make the healthcare system more efficient and even improve health while doing so. Finally, acting sooner rather than later means a better chance of holding down federal debt levels, encouraging economic growth, and improving living standards. Now, that's just a snapshot of our healthcare system. It can certainly be complicated to follow or understand. It's not financially sound, and it's still expensive. So, as a matter of being realistic, it's time for some bipartisan reform. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.